Accession number 9338, reel 11.
You were talking about areas of the West. Doug Turner, tape 11. Doug, you were talking about problems associated with your task when you were in the southwest of China. You know, bandits, and how sometimes your supplies were robbed. Did you have any problems like that in Hunan?
There's certainly no bandit problems from my own experience. No, there wasn't the same situation. The geographical situation is quite different. We were stable and static in Hunan, whereas in China, of course, we were constantly on the road in very treacherous country.
Did you ever have need to travel, for instance? Did you have to go to Shanghai or any other
areas? No, not a great deal. The work was taking on a different shape altogether. We had stable projects, and from the time I arrived, I spent nearly all my time in the villages, in Zhongmu and the related villages around that area. Zhengzhou, of course, was still the headquarters at the time, but that was 30 miles away, and we had no vehicles of our own, and we saw them perhaps once a fortnight when they might send in a few supplies. But if we wanted to go in, then we had to wait for a vehicle to come along. Otherwise, there was no transport at all. We were quite isolated. Indeed, it was difficult at times to get into contact with them. Of course, no civil telephone lines were working, and I had to beg the use of a telephone from the military commandant in order to contact headquarters.
Yes, I was going to ask you about communications, you know, how you got on at this time with communications with other areas of China or the outside world. You know, were you getting mail from home?
Yes, the mail was remarkably good. At times one would receive an air letter in the space of 8 days, which I thought was fantastic in those days. Still is today, I should think. It was quite good. Usually it may take up to a fortnight or so, but on balance, the mails were very good. One of the interesting little incidents of the Chinese postal system, which was very efficient. It had been run by the French for quite a time, and even during the Civil War, when towns changed and cities changed hands, you would still see the green uniformed postman going along with his mail, no matter who occupied the area. One of the few things in China which worked, oddly enough, if I may just go back to West China for a moment, our hostel in Kunming consisted of using the residence of the chief postmaster there, Stamp Smith, as we called him, and he was a delightful old character who loved having us there. But we had this sort of, when it came to a transport system, we had a kind of a love-hate relationship, because he used to boast of the efficiency of his post office lorries travelling over all these thousands of miles, and used to compare them with our own. And very often we thought we were efficient, but the Chinese post office lorries were quite often ahead of us in organisation. Quite a friendly enmity going on between Stamp and the rest of us.
You mentioned, I think it was in the context of the student unrest, and perhaps the speech you made, the secret police. Did you have much to do with these? Were they much in evidence, the secret police?
They were to the Chinese people, of course.
Were they?
Yes. The only occurrence I can positively recall now was in Zhongmu itself, when I suppose he must have come from a local military encampment there, I'm not sure, but it was his job to go around all the foreigners in his area and get them to fill in the necessary forms, and he brought along form for me to fill in, and I looked at it, and whilst some of the questions are fairly innocuous, name, age, and nationality, one of the questions was, what are your political thoughts? And I refused to answer this, and he insisted, and I still refused. And he was very embarrassed by this. He was a rather funny little man, I think possibly with very little education, and he was all obviously under very strict orders to obtain a fully completed document. And he would come along daily and insist that I complete the form, and I always consistently refused. And in the end, I began to get a little annoyed with his constant requests, and he would give a mirthless smile as I refused, and he would again insist. And on one occasion, he found me walking along beside the banks of the Yellow River, and I got a little annoyed, and I said, look, any more questions from you and I shall dump you in the Yellow River. And he again smiled mirthlessly, and I hope he did never understood, or he treated it as a joke. Anyway, soon after that, I got no more visits.
You're saying the Chinese people certainly felt the presence of the secret police?
Yes. There was one incident when the Chinese army were conscripting the local peasants, and we wanted to start a project in one of the villages, and we made arrangements to see the local leader, and we went along, and he was not to be found. And on first inquiry, they said, well, he just wasn't, he was absent from the village. But as they became aware that we had every good intention, they told us that he had fled because he was under constant pressure from the government to find 19 conscripts from his area, and he just didn't want to have anything to do with it. Anyway, ultimately, we did arrange a meeting with him by evening, and he came along, and he was very friendly towards us. But he pointed out the difficulties he was under, and this was a secret meeting. And he was quite angry, and he said he, under no circumstances was he going to abide by the request of the authorities to find young men who were so badly needed by their families and the villages to begin to rehabilitate themselves. And again, he went into hiding.
Could you tell me something about your social life in China? You know, this will include the West China as well as Hunan. You know, how did you amuse yourself in the time off that you had?
Well, certainly on the road. I mean, we slept in our trucks at night, and we always used to carry a load of books with us to read, because you know, when we drew in into a little town at night to have a meal and rest, then we would sit in our trucks and read all sorts of stories. Fortunately, we were able to obtain hundreds, if not thousands, of books from the U.S. forces, which they had paperbacks galore, and they had a wonderful assortment ranging from the simply pornographic to the highly classical literature. And so we had a wonderful choice to choose from, Wild Western. So I don't think I've ever read so many Wild West stories in my life, but it's amazing how relaxing it was of an evening to read the literature. I read Turgenev and God knows what else whilst on the road. In the evening, if we were back in hostel, on the hostels, then we used to muck in together with one another, or yarn together, or swap lies and stories and all things like this, or wander around the towns and cities, maybe occasionally go out for a meal, maybe occasionally go along to one of the local cinemas and watch a highly censored Western film, which after it had been censored, we couldn't make head or tail of course. But nevertheless, everybody thoroughly enjoyed themselves. The Chinese enjoyed the film. Maybe they even understood the stories more than we did at times. We had a good time, and maybe we might go along to one of the Chinese shows, a Chinese opera or something like this. Of course, which we couldn't make head or tail of, but we thoroughly enjoyed the experience. Everybody spitting melon seeds everywhere, and everybody chattering at the same time. Things like this, or sometimes we might even go out into on a Sunday if we weren't out on the road. Take one of the jeeps and go out into the countryside. And on one occasion, I certainly remember a group of us went out into the unknown, and we just took on, drove out into nowhere in particular, and came to a lane and followed it through, and ultimately arrived in a very, very wonderful valley, almost like a Shangri-La valley. It was really a wonderful time, and only recently I've been having correspondence with one of my old comrades, and strangely enough, I mentioned this experience to him, and he said, "How funny you should recall this." He said, "It remains so strongly in my own mind. In fact, I even wrote a story around it of that day. Unfortunately, I've lost the story."
Did you enjoy China then?
Thoroughly. Thoroughly.
Were you able to sort of learn its culture, and did you go to the temples?
I suppose we tended most of the time to be flung in on our own resources. I wouldn't say that we were old China hands in the sense of being highly and intellectually aware, but some of the members certainly learnt the language very well and were able to carry on quite good conversations in Chinese, much to their delight. If they ever had this sort of experience, they would give the foreigner a wonderful hand clap. But some of us are rather... But our work was so, you know, self-engrossing that we didn't get an awful lot of time to study the culture as such, or to become get involved in its literature. It just wasn't the opportunity.
And in Hunan, was it very different, you know, your sort of social activity there?
Yes, it was, yes. In the cities, of course, like if they were at a main hospital like Zhengzhou, then, of course, they had their own structure. They had good meals, regular meals, comfortable quarters, and they had their own social life after they'd finished their work, well catered for. We don't know quite what they got up to, but we used to regard ourselves as really living in China, and used to accuse them of living in the flesh pots of Zhengzhou, and they would accuse us of being the wild men of the backwoods. And we were living on mainly on very simple food in the villages, living in mud huts. We had our own unit structure as well, but there were probably, because of the conditions, I think we had less opportunity to relieve any tensions which might build up than those in the city. They had the better life of it on balance. We didn't envy them this. We would prefer to be where we were, but obviously when you've got a small group of people living in closely confined conditions... you can perhaps get a little more uptight than you would in a wider situation, but we took part in the cultural life of the village in so far as this was possible. Mainly, this was at a working level. We had a wonderful relationship with our landlady, who was a Chinese Christian, and she thoroughly enjoyed having us. There was always good fun going on, and pulling of one another's legs, and quite unseemly, I'm sure, to the cultured Chinese and the literary Chinese, and quite unseemly, I'm sure, to the more uptight to foreigners. But the relationships between ourselves and the Lao Beixing, or the common people of the village, was wonderful, wonderful. the old landlady and her family, we really love one another.
You mentioned earlier, I think, that there were some weddings that some people, some of the unit, married in China. Is that right?
Some of our members, yes. One or two, quite a few marriages went on out there. There were the unit, holy unit marriages, and then a number of marriages between Chinese members and European members and Chinese girls, or Chinese members, and are highly successful. Yes, one of our doctors, two of our doctors, married Chinese girls, now living in England.
Were there any strict rules at all? You know, perhaps strictness is a word you don't apply to Quaker organisations, but were there any guidelines about sort of behaviour with the opposite sex?
No, I think it was a very natural behaviour indeed. Obviously, being young men, we're always delighted having female company, as you can imagine. Why not? But there was never any, to my knowledge, any tension ever arising out of this. As I think I commented earlier on, the comment of a new female to one of the units was, well, they didn't seem to mind having women there at all. In other words, we treated them just as we would our own male members. It was a very natural and very healthy relationship.
This is an issue which has sometimes cropped up with pacifists, you know, whether or not your self-image as a man was affected by being a pacifist. I wonder how you would react to that.
Yeah, I think it's a very good question, this. In fact, you mean, does being a pacifist tend to inhibit the masculine part of our nature? It's a good question. I think it may well do at certain levels. I think one has to be terribly mature at in some instances. I suppose it can do. Masculinity suggests virility, and being a pacifist, I suppose you tend to question your own identity in this respect. I'm quite sure that in ordinary life this may well have played a part. I think within the unit it played very little part, indeed, I think, because we were actively doing a very masculine job, whereas I imagine that in ordinary Western life, pacifists could perhaps feel a little more inhibited than they were by nature. They felt they had to express their pacifism by a gentleness, perhaps sometimes teeming on the meek, that we shouldn't, the policy of non-resistance versus non-violent resistance, perhaps. I'm sure it must have made a lot of people think. For myself, I imagine that I may very well have had those inhibitory tendencies within me. I don't think I ever expressed them very positively, but I think I may have had them. But I think my period with the unit certainly diminished them quite a lot, you know. And I regained a very necessary virility and masculinity.
Do you think it was ever the case that pacifists were, you know, particularly pacifist in a group, as often you had to be, you were perceived as what we would now say gay, homosexual?
I don't think it ever occurred in any way at all. I did hear of that those who were working with the French felt that the French were regarding them a little oddly, thinking how strange that all these young men should come together and work together without women. But I think that was an attitude of the French, not of the anyone else. I think it was quite an isolated incident.
Were there Chinese prostitutes? You know, was this prevalent?
Yes, I think this was an indictment of the one of the tragedies of China. Obviously, the war had brought a lot of prostitution into existence. So the building of roads along which went a constant flow of trucks of the army and the armies, commercial drivers of all sorts, the trade built up, and very often eating houses would have their own prostitutes living there. I, on one occasion, when I'd broken down, I had to stay in the town until rescue trucks came out, and there was quite a friendly prostitute there who would always greet me with a grin, and her offerings to me made me feel very embarrassed at times. I was still very inhibited then. But she would laugh loudly at my endeavours to escape the conversation, and used to roar with laughter and pass on my comments to every other inhabitant of the eating house, much to my many blushes, and I would tend to flee. But if one was in company with the other members, then of course we could take it and joke back, and of course we did. But it was rather sad to see all these young girls and very, you know, sometimes old women engaged in this. This was their life.
Was there a lot of BD associated with that?
I imagine so. It's almost inevitable. Shanghai, of course, was absolutely full of them. I mean, you couldn't walk hardly 10 yards without you being accosted there. But the Chinese accepted it. It was part of their life. And very friendly.
What would the attitude of the unit have been, you know, about the organisation generally towards members in that respect? You know, were you warned off?
Oh, yes. I mean, obviously in our training we were constantly warned about this. If the doctor was had tendency to moral scruples, then he was quite strict about this, whereas a more cynical young physician would take a joking approach to it and just warn us of what might happen were we so tempted. I don't think many succumbed, if any. I've never heard of any at all. Possibly it did, I don't know. I mean, human nature is human nature, and the temptation was there. But I certainly never heard of any, and I imagine it didn't. We might have been tempted, but certainly the end results, I think, would have frightened all of us off.
When you actually joined the unit, did you have to take any pledges?
No.
That you would behave in a certain way?
No, none at all. I mean, you know, we were chosen, I'm sure, because of our character, our way of thinking, and this was accepted. Never any question arose to my knowledge. I think if incidents might have arisen, of course they may very well have arisen, then it was handled at a very tactful level. But all in all, it was a very natural democratic relationship between one another, and we extended that to all and sundry.
How long did the convoy continue in China?
Well, it continued on for quite a little while, but obviously the work was drawing to an end, and then...
By what time would that be drawing to an end?
Well, this must have been well into 1947. Certainly the hostel was maintained at Chongqing, and there I think those who were left began to start running small clinics.
Was the whole thing sort of gradually wound down, would you say?
That was the intention, yes, but there was, had been the expressed hope of many of us that we could develop new work in the far southwest of China, in the tribal areas, way down beyond nowhere, towards towards French Indochina, as it was then. This was our hope, but of course, with the communist takeover, this became more and more remote. It never occurred.
When did you actually leave China, Doug?
I left in September 1947.
Would you have been one of the last to go, do you think?
No, because the unit was still carrying on and the communists had not yet taken over. And we hoped that with our growing relationships with them that we would still be able to continue. This was our one hope because we had access to both sides of the line and we hoped that they would be willing to accept us. And of course the Yan'an team continued for quite a time after that.
Why did you return then?
Well, I'd gone out for 2 years at the time and I'd had hookworm and other tummy troubles. And I felt I needed to return. And also I think I wanted to come back in order to build up again the possibilities of returning for a longer period. That was certainly my intention of returning to China.